You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of July 2017 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
There was nothing to tell. I mean, I wouldn't have even remembered it until you start scouring through the stuff. It was literally just a wasted 20 minutes, which was a shame.
Which doesn't explain why Donald Trump Jr. agreed to meet a Russian lawyer on the promise of material compromising his father's opponent in the first place. But what does? My guests Sir William Patey and Carol Walker will be here discussing this and the day's other top stories, including French President Emmanuel Macron's plans for reinvigorating the Western alliance, Saudi Arabia's somewhat backfiring attempts to paint Qatar as a terror sponsor, and...
Yes, a little tear.
Yes. At that moment.
At that moment, yes.
Why are we so surprised by admissions or exhibitions of vulnerability by our political leaders? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. Welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Sir William Patey, International Affairs Advisor, Control Risks, and former British Ambassador to Iraq and Saudi Arabia, among others, and Carol Walker, Political Analyst and Commentator. Welcome both. We will start tonight in Washington and what we are continuing to learn from Tuesday's email dump by Donald Trump Jr. While the precise parameters of his father's relationship with the Kremlin remain maddeningly opaque, we do now know that a key figure in it is one Amin Agalarov, the pop star of a Russian property billionaire known to the weirdly numerous fans of his dreadful music as Amin.
Girl, you got me so bad. You got my heartbeat faster than a train running off the tracks. And girl, your body's so cruel.
Yes, I think we have the idea there. That was Amin's recent release, Good Love. It was, of course, Amin's publicist, Rob Goldstone, who set up the meeting with the Russian contact that Trump Jr. had previously insisted he'd never had. Carol, we do now that Trump Sr. also knows Amin and has indeed appeared in one of his videos. We have also learned about Amin that he's the former son-in-law of the president of Azerbaijan, Ilham Aliyev. Is this weird company for a president of the United States to have been keeping?
He does seem to have some rather unusual connections, doesn't he? It seems that their friendship, their connection goes back to their efforts to bring the Miss Universe contest, which of course was owned by Donald Trump, to Moscow back in 2013. That was a successful venture, and it seems that the connections have continued there. I mean, we hear back in the UK, leaders like Theresa May was criticised for her closeness to a couple of advisers. But Donald Trump does seem to have a lot of very unusual connections. But Amin, like him, is a real estate tycoon. But I think behind all of this, what we've seen in recent days is that after all the denials of any attempts or any connections between the Trump team and Russia, here we had his son who was offered material, offered a meeting, and was told that this material was part of Russia's support for Trump. That was what was said in one of these emails.
The phrase part of intrigues me, and I think there may be more where this came from. William, connections like this, if an entertainer similar to Donald Trump possessed them in the 1960s, would have gotten them blacklisted by the Republican Party. Is it possible that there is actually an entirely innocent explanation for all of this?
Well, there might be, but I mean, Donald Trump Jr.'s defence is that this was all a damp squib because she didn't have any information. The fact that he sought information from a Russian source to damage the electoral candidate seems to think that's not an issue. But I think the whole Russia connection with Trump is kind of sucking the oxygen out of politics for Trump. He can't concentrate on anything else. So there's two strands to this. There's one, what role did Russia play in trying to undermine Hillary Clinton's electoral prospects and promote Donald Trump's? And there's also the yet unexplored, well, not explored fully, the 1990 connections. You know, what role did Russian banks and oligarchs play in saving some of Donald Trump, lending money to Donald Trump in the 90s when he was in trouble, and even Jared Kushner? So you've got those financial connections from the 90s still there, hanging over him, plus the electoral stuff. This Russia story's got more to run, I think.
It doubtless has, Carol, but the thing is that we don't yet have an actual smoking gun, do we? But do we now have, as of Tuesday, at least an idea of what a smoking gun might look like when we find one?
Well, we've got at least a couple of very powerful investigations going on in Washington which are seeking to get to the bottom of this and find out if there really is a smoking gun, and indeed if there really is proper incriminating evidence. But what we seem to have seen from these emails is the fact that Donald Trump's son was very happy to have a meeting with a Russian lawyer who was offering what she said was documents which would show, which would could be used against his rival at the time, Hillary Clinton. And the only problem from the Trump point of view was that they were very disappointed that they didn't get what they wanted, that Trump Jr. came away from this meeting without having got the material he'd been promised. And I think what William says is absolutely right, is that the problem for Donald Trump is that it's difficult for him to move on from this. We saw him with that much heralded meeting with President Putin at the G8. All the questions were, are you going to tackle him about this? And of course, he came out and said, well, actually, it's fine, because I asked President Putin if he'd meddled in the election, and he said no. So he gave me an absolute assurance on that. So as far as Donald Trump's concerned, he's raised the issue, but it's not going to go away.
And in a contest over the truth between a retired game show host and a former KGB officer, I mean, who's likely to come out on top in that interrogation, do you think?
I think we've not yet seen the full truth.
But looking again at the meeting, William, is there a possible excuse for Donald Trump Jr. just on the grounds of, well, let's be charitable and call it inexperience? Because an experienced political operative knows that if you get, well, one would hope knows that if you get an email from some slightly flaky source saying, I've got a Russian lawyer with ties to the Kremlin who's got compromising material on your opponent, you don't go anywhere near that. What you do is send back an email saying in writing, I am absolutely 100% not interested in this. Please don't bring anything like this to me ever again.
Well, you'd think so, and there is a degree of inexperience. My understanding is that Jared Kushner was also in on this.
He was copied in, yes.
He's copied in. So there's an element of, we can perhaps forgive the son of the president who's not politically involved, but Jared Kushner now is a key advisor to the president, and
with security clearance,
and may not have mentioned this involvement at an earlier stage of his security clearance. So, you know, it's all about the cover up, isn't it? You know, what who said what to when? Sometimes the substance is the least important bit.
And the head of the FBI has said that anyone who was involved in any campaign who was approached in any way like this should have come straight to the FBI and said, look, I've got somebody who is clearly acting on behalf of an outside power, in this case Russia, who's offering me something, and should have reported it. So there do seem to be some fairly basic rules there, which even somebody pretty inexperienced might perhaps have just about been aware of.
Well, I think we've actually now learned at least who replies to those Nigerian emails offering you a share of Sani Abacha's bullion in return for your bank details. But moving seamlessly along, President Donald Trump has today arrived in Paris, where tomorrow he is to be the Bastille Day guest of President Emmanuel Macron. It might be a long day if Trump has read an interview which Macron gave to West France, in which the French leader reflected that the West had been cracking since Trump was elected, and making specific reference to Trump's hostility to climate change accords. Macron also said Americans will be part of the Paris Agreement, whether the government wants them to or not. William, first of all, Macron is also overseeing a meeting today in Paris of the French and German cabinets. Is he attempting to position himself as kind of Angela Merkel's co-leader of the free world in what we hope is America's temporary absence?
Well, I think he's probably has aspirations to be the leader of the free world, take over. He is a great fan of de Gaulle. He certainly seems to want to position himself as the frank partner of the United States. I think Britain has vacated a role, frankly, in Europe. There's a vacuum there. I think Macron is seeking to see himself as the key interlocutor between between the US and Europe. Merkel-Trump relations are not that great. Britain will be seen as too preoccupied and more of a poodle of the United States than they have been in the past. So I think there's an opportunity for Macron here, and I think he's grasping it. He knows that Trump likes a bit of ceremony and likes a good parade, and he's invited them to their biggest one.
Just further on that, Carol, that point that William makes, that this isn't just about Trump, it is to an extent about Britain as well. If we do see France and Germany either in closer competition or closer rivalry or possibly a mix of the two, is that more about Britain leaving the EU than about Trump being president of the United States? Because they will have to be thinking of, they can certainly think of Trump as a temporary condition, but as it presently stands, Britain leaving the EU is a permanent fact of life.
Absolutely. And I think there's no doubt that new President Macron, who's reveling in his new power and popularity, wants to use that
mood.
He's
clearly enjoying himself, isn't
he? He's clearly enjoying himself, and he clearly doesn't lack ambition, as I think William has pointed out there. He clearly sees that relationship with Angela Merkel as crucial in driving forward Europe and preventing Brexit from leading to a greater disintegration of the European project. Of course, there always used to be, when we had Sarkozy in power in France, he and Merkel were the two powerhouses who together were driving forward what they saw as the European project, greater integration, greater power. And I think that what President Macron would like to do would be, if you like, to resume that process. And I think he is hoping that Brexit might even make that process easier, because, of course, it was always Britain that was holding out against greater integration, greater assuming of powers towards the centre in Europe. And I think that what he will want to do now is to use this Macron, as people have called it, the Macron-Merkel axis,
to try and
ensure that Europe not just survives Britain's departure, but can then forge a new course and can then integrate further and can then assume greater power and thus greater importance for the EU on the world stage.
William, the EU, or the EC as originally was, I mean, fundamentally was founded in a bid to try and find a way to stop France and Germany from kicking lumps out of each other every other generation, which they've obviously had a centuries-long history of doing. Have the two countries entirely got used to the idea that they are now in fact allies? Is any kind of cooperation between them in leading Europe inevitably just going to lend to rivalry of some sort or another?
No, I think the EU, the whole process of the EU has been absolutely successful in binding France and Germany together. I think we talk in terms of rivalry, but not in terms of pre-Second World War. I think France and Germany sees itself as two countries at the heart of Europe. And I think the links between them are very, very strong. Britain, when it was a committed member of the European Union, well, were we ever committed? But when we were in, always tried to be the third leg of a three-legged stool, but that we always found the French-German access much stronger than either the British French or the British German, and I think that has remained. I think there was a great sigh of relief in Germany when Macron became president, because that just continues a long tradition.
Carol, do you get the sense that Donald Trump, whether he realises or cares or not, is being used as something of a a lever by Macron in this particular rivalry. As you know, as we've been discussing, and as is painfully obvious, Trump and Merkel, I think, possibly have a certain amount of difficulty relating to each other. Does Macron perceive, do we think, a certain advantage in being the Western European leader that, you know, makes an effort with Donald Trump? They're putting on a big parade for him tomorrow. They'll make a dreadful fuss of him. Is that where Macron's going with this?
I think Macron realises the importance of the EU's relationship with the United States. And yes, he is canny enough to realise that there is a good deal of tension between Angela Merkel and Donald Trump. It is interesting that Donald Trump, who was slightly rude about Macron initially, appears to have overcome his misgivings and is now himself keen to try to use the fantastic pomp and ceremony that he's going to be a part of in Paris to boost his own prestige. And so I think what you're seeing here with Macron and Trump is two leaders who can see mutual benefits. Certainly the EU knows that US is an important partner. And I think President Trump believes that if he can be feted in Paris, despite having said in the past that it was far too dangerous to go out on the streets in Paris after the terrorist attack.
His friend Jim, apparently, was the one who was terribly scared of going to Paris.
Well, he's obviously been reassured because he's going to be out there over the next day or so amidst all the crowds. And I think both of them see this now as an opportunity. President Macron knows that if the EU is going to strengthen itself, it needs to be seen as a significant world power. And I think he will be hoping that he can use his influence on Trump on things like the climate change agreement and thus gain even more prestige for himself in perhaps softening some of President Trump's less acceptable to the point from the point of view of the rest of Europe, softening some of those views.
William, just from the diplomatic point of view, the world has spent the last 6 months, of course, trying to figure out how to deal with Donald Trump and how to relate to Donald Trump. Have we yet understood whether he responds better to flattery, which a lot of people have tried, or strength, which has been what Macron has tried to do, literally in the case of a couple of famous handshakes?
Yes, so I think Macron feels now that he's passed the handshake test that he can be a bit friendlier. I don't know. I mean, I think we're still finding out what's the best way to deal with Donald Trump. He bears grudges, we know that. So insulting him is never good if you want to be on good terms with him. I think strength, but, you know, if you provoke him, who knows what he'll do. I think in foreign policy, his biggest foreign policy success was in bombing Syria. He got great praise from that. So if that's how he sees it, we need to be a bit worried. So I think we're still finding our way.
OK, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Sir William Patey and Carol Walker. Coming up next, Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Stay tuned.
Summer is officially here, and so is Monocle's bumper July-August double issue. Here we celebrate quality of life and reveal this year's rundown of the top 25 cities to live in worldwide. We also meet the people striving to make life in their cities better, from the mayor of Los Angeles to the sunny team that looks after Tokyo's parks and gardens, to the urban heroes giving back to their hometowns. Meanwhile, in design, we cast our gaze up to the rooftops in Milan and find a hidden and surprisingly verdant world above the fray. And of course, we've always got room for a bit of pure hedonism as we dance the night away in Tel Aviv, unwind in Finland's most inviting and steamiest company retreats, and tuck into some sun-kissed beach food in Valencia. And speaking of sun-kissed, we also sit down with Mario Testino for his hypothetical last meal. That's all in the July-August issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
You're back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Muller, still with me, are Carol Walker and Sir William Patey. Now, since Saudi Arabia began its blockade of Qatar, more than a few observers have suggested that the stated reason for it, which was Qatar's alleged funding and encouragement of Islamist terrorism, might just expose Riyadh to accusations of hypocrisy. The government of the UK yesterday published an extremely brief summary of a long-delayed report into the funding of extremism. The full report is being withheld for security reasons. This has been widely interpreted as an unwillingness to annoy the Saudis. William, you of course worked in Saudi Arabia. You were the UK's ambassador there. It is kind of a common wisdom, much bandied about, especially in recent weeks as the Saudis have tried to make a thing of this, that Saudis themselves are funders, exporters, encouragers, etc. of Islamist terrorism. Is that entirely fair?
I don't think it's fair at all. It has become a common wisdom. As you say, no one challenges it. I think part of the problem is that Saudi Arabia in the past, in the 80s and 90s and probably the early part of the noughties, did fund mosques. A lot of those mosques, in adopting Wahhabi Salafist ideology, have ended up producing, not all of them, but some of them have produced extremists who've gone on to support terrorism. And through that connection, Saudi Arabia gets accused of funding terrorism.
So is this an unintended consequence as far as the Saudis are concerned?
I think it is. And I think that's where, you know, we need to have a dialogue with the Saudis, that your particular ideology, religious ideology, may be right for you, but when transported to a pluralist society, has unintended consequences. And that's the dialogue we have to have. I think, you know, they're being held to the same standards. Qatar is actually supporting groups and movements within the Middle East that threaten the stability and security of Saudi Arabia and the UAE. So there is a difference there. And I think we do need to talk to the Saudis about what happens when you fund mosques, you export your religious texts, you export your educational books. The impact that has on a pluralist society is unacceptable.
But just to follow that up, if you just talk about it as the Saudis exporting an ideology, and many countries around the world do that, but were they doing it out of sincere religious and or ideological conviction, or was it a means to an end? Were they attempting to cause a certain amount of disruption in those pluralist societies you mentioned?
Well, I think it's part of their self-identity. The Saudis, and certainly the Al-Saud, the rulers, see themselves as the leaders of the Islamic world. So they host the two holiest sites in Islam, Mecca and Medina. The king is known as the custodian of the two holy mosques. And a lot of this happened at the same time of the Iranian Revolution, which is a revolutionary organization exporting Shia ideology. So at the time, part of this was Saudi counter to revolutionary Iran, but also it's seeing itself as the fount of Islamic wisdom, if you like. So it's part of their self-identity. So that's why they were doing it. They genuinely believe in their particular religious form of worship. So they did it out of conviction, I think, not because they wanted to spread extremism.
Carol, as we mentioned there in the introduction, the UK has issued this very terse summary of this long-suppressed report. From a British political perspective, how awkward do they find the relationship with Saudi Arabia, which does not really get... It's never got any British government a great deal of good press.
It is a very delicate but a very important relationship for the British government. As we know, they have a big defence connections with the Saudis. We saw that visit that Theresa May made to Saudi, where she was criticised for not sufficiently standing up to the Saudis, in particular over the action that they're taking in Yemen. Of course, the Saudis would maintain that they are simply defending their own interests in Yemen and against the uprising that is going on there across the border. But the Saudi-UK relationship is an important one, and so is the Saudi-US relationship. And I think that is why it's fascinating to see it now, Rex Tillerson shuttling around these Gulf states, trying to resolve this crisis which is going on with the blockade on Qatar, because the US values the Saudi relationship, but it also values the relationship with Qatar, where it has the main base that it uses, and Qatar is part of the alliance which is tackling IS in Syria. So I think the overriding concern and objective of both the US and the UK at the moment is to try to calm down the tension amongst these Gulf states. They simply don't want to go into these details of who is funding which terrorist organisations. They do not want to open up these potential cans of worms. They want to try to diffuse the situation, diffuse the crisis, find a way of ending the blockade and doing so in a way that protects their own interests.
OK, well, finally tonight, we will move on to UK Prime Minister Theresa May. She has admitted that she shed a tear upon being told of the exit poll numbers on election night, which suggested not merely that the landslide she'd anticipated had failed to occur, but that her gamble had left her rather worse off. So, does crying have a place in politics? First of all, our producer, Ben Ryland, takes a closer look.
As the tears fell from the eyes of President Barack Obama, theories began to swirl as to just how exactly they had materialised. Some saw a suspicious wipe before the tears were visible. Ah, that must be it. He's dabbing menthol below his eyes. Others were aghast at how good an actor the president must be. Most people, of course, saw a leader struggling to comprehend how his position as the world's most powerful politician failed to deliver enough of a mandate to curb the prevalence of mass shootings.
Every time I think about those kids, it gets me mad. And by the way, it happens on the streets of Chicago every day.
When critics questioned the legitimacy of Barack Obama's tears, they also perhaps indirectly spoke to the impact that genuine displays of emotion can deliver.
This, above all, is why Australians are so overwhelmingly supportive of disability care.
That was former Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard speaking in Parliament during the introduction of the country's disability insurance scheme, one of her signature policies. Her time in government was plagued by negative press coverage for her perceived lack of authenticity. Her tearful speech, however, attracted criticism for perhaps being too authentic, a paradoxical dilemma faced all too often by women in politics.
We notice now that it's affecting you now, and it must have been
yes,
the
it's not
most
affecting
difficult.
My voice now. It's not affecting my voice. You're thinking back to traumatic things. But I managed to get through them. I managed to get through the television. I managed to get through the cabinet, again because there was something else to do.
In an interview shortly after the end of her time as Britain's Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher shed tears as she recalled the events leading up to her resignation. And who better than the Iron Lady herself to brush aside any suggestion that emotion might equal weakness?
By that time, I was back fighting fit.
Of course, it's not only democratically elected leaders who are prone to public displays of emotion. At a victory speech in 2012, even Russia's Vladimir Putin welled up as he prepared to flex his political muscle once again.
Всем, кто поддерживает нас в каждом уголке нашей огромной, необъятной родины. Спасибо всем.
Ben Ryland there, reviewing recent emotional outbursts in politics. William, it probably wouldn't do to have a national leader who burst into tears at every public appearance, but you'd start to worry. Is there a time and a place for it?
Well, I think when it's natural, when you genuinely feel emotion, when something personally touches you. I was, you know, when David Cameron talked about the death of his children, nobody doubted that that was genuine. So I suppose if it affects you, Theresa May suggesting she shed a tear. I mean, if you didn't shed a tear when you thought you were going to win 100 seats, and didn't you, people would begin to question you. So one questions why she's telling us now, perhaps because of her being described as a robot. So she wants to convince us that she's someone with emotional intelligence.
Carol, is there? I mean, there is in all areas of politics, and I guess in all areas of life. But on this one particularly, is there a different standard applied to women? Are women more obliged to guard against displays like that? I think often when it's a tough male leader, it comes across as a sort of display of human vulnerability.
I think there is a danger that you don't want to be seen as a weepy woman. But I think, as William says, if it's genuine, then I think people understand it. I think the problem from Theresa May is that I'm not sure that her admission that she shed a tear when she realised she completely screwed up the election campaign and come away with having thrown away her majority instead of increased it, I'm not sure that's going to get her a huge sympathy vote. Yet we're all a pretty cynical lot these days. And as William said, she was criticised for being so robotic that she got this name, the Maybot. And people will wonder whether this was designed to show that, well, she really is human after all. But of course, the Lib Dem leader, Tim Farron, has already said, well, the whole nation's going to be weeping if she carries out her vision of Brexit.
Bazing. And that does bring us to the end of today's show. William Patey and Carol Walker, thank you both very much for joining us. The show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Claire Urban. Music next at 1900. It's The Urbanist. There's more on the day's big stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House is back same time. Easy for me to say tomorrow, 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.